Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today it's Shiraz Mayer talking about Salafi jihadism.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction. Thank you very much to Chalk Valley History Festival for having me here as well. And indeed, thank you to all of you for taking some time out the weekend to come and study, to learn about, to hear about what is, I think, quite a confusing topic sometimes. What is a topic that has lots of unusual, weird, slightly exotic terms associated with it that aren't necessarily always particularly well understood, but do appear in public debate quite a lot. We see them in the press being used quite a lot. And so that's really what I set out to do when I wrote a book by this name, was to try and explain that question that everyone has been asking ever since, I suppose, September the 11th, 2001, which was, what do these guys believe? Why are they doing it? And so in order to do that, I wanted to write a book that looked at ideology. And there were some that had come before that I didn't think did it particularly well. And so I wanted to start to try and get to grips with that idea. And that's ultimately what I hope to share with you today, is to walk you through some of my thinking on this, to try and essentially answer a question, which is, why does someone who joins ISIS or who joins Al-Qaeda do the things that they do? Why do they believe the things they believe? And how does that shape and mold and guide and direct their actions as they go through their day-to-day lives and the things that they're doing? So in essence, I want to try and help you understand Salafi jihadism in that way. And I'll build very slowly at the start. So if you do have some pre-existing knowledge, you know, you will slightly hear some of the things that you already know. The world of Islam in general is divided between Sunnis and Shias. And of course, the vast majority of Muslims are Sunni. Look, about 90%, just under 90% of the world's Muslims are Sunnis. And then the Shia, which comprise the next largest block, of course, make up the rest. And you will have heard a lot about the so-called Sunni-Shia divide, particularly in relation to the ongoing conflict in the Levant, in Syria and Iraq, particularly over the last few years, and the way that these two different groups, or certainly the militant actors within them, are attempting to try to give their version of Islam a slightly more dominant view in that way. Salafism, which is what we're looking at today, comes from the Sunni side of Islam. So it comes from the larger side, and Salafism is a term that has become slightly better known in the West over the last decade or so, and you're seeing more English language literature now beginning to look at this movement. So what is it? And what does it really attempt to say and do? Well, Salafism, to put it in essence, is a tradition that exists within Islam, which is a kind of sociological philosophy. It's a philosophy about how to lead the good Muslim life. It's a philosophy about a doctrine of salvation, of trying to get back to that authentic era of Islam. And where it comes from is that within Islam, you have multiple bodies of law. The best known, of course, is the Quran, which is the primary body of law. But next to that, you have something called the Hadith. And these are the recorded actions, sayings, traditions, lessons of the Prophet Muhammad. And the way I tell my students to think about this is to think of the Hadith as being footnotes to the Quran. They sort of fills in and populates the broader aspects of what you're seeing and adds in slightly more fine-grained kind of ideas about some of the things that Muslims are thinking and doing. And so one of the Hadith talks about an incident where the Prophet Muhammad is with his companions, and the companions are known as the Sahaba in Arabic. And so one of the companions comes and says, look, who are the best Muslims? Who are the best of the people of your nation, of the Islamic nation? Like, in essence, what makes the best Muslim? And he said, the generation that is with me, i.e. the Sahaba. He says, and then the generation after me, and the generation after them. In Arabic, these are known as the Tabi'een and the Tabi'tabi'een. So this movement, the Salafi movement, basically took that Hadith and that understanding and said, right, these first three generations of Islam, these first three generations that surrounded the Prophet Muhammad, that knew him as he lived and breathed and was around and had knowledge of him within living memory, they constitute the golden era of Islam. They constitute the ultimate age of authority, of piety, of purity, and authenticity. Therefore, we want to replicate them. Because if we can replicate them, because they were mortals, they're not the prophet. If we can replicate them, then we're going back to that ultimate era. So they called that first three generations to be something known as the Salaf al-Saleh, the pious predecessors. And they're the people they aim to revive and whose lives they want to live. And that's where the term Salafi and Salafism comes from. So they want to go back to the lives. Now, what's interesting then about that doctrine is this notion that, in fact, to be progressive, to be religiously progressive, to move back to an era of, as I say, authenticity, of purity and so on, what you have to do is to be regressive. You have to pull back and go towards that era, in fact, where people were living the lives as they were surrounding the Prophet. So the sort of progress through regression is what fundamentally the philosophical worldview comes down to. So today, if you see a Salafi in the modern world, they're people who you would say are sort of most identifiably visually as being Muslim. For men, they tend to wear the sort of long unkempt beards and flowing robes. The women tend to wear the niqab, the face veil, not just the headscarf. And these are people who, as I say, when you see them, are pretty much subscribing to a Salafi point of view. Now, the issue is, why would you want to be a Salafi? Why is that so important within Islam? So the Prophet says, look, they're the golden era. They're the best of the generation. So that's one strong driver for why you would want to become a Salafi, why you'd want to live the Salafi life. But there's another aspect to it too, which explains why Salafism is so unbending, why it's so conservative, why it's so opposed to modernity, why it's so opposed to Reformation, why it's so opposed to anything that might be considered new or different or innovative. And that comes from it's an Islamic understanding of history that these individuals have. They view the sort of chain of different religions, the dawn of different religions, the existence of different religions, almost from a sort of Whig view of history. And by that, what I mean is religions that came before were necessary but insufficient. So you may have heard, for example, Muslim preachers say, or you've seen it around where they say, previous prophets, Islam reaffirms their message. Islam reaffirms the message of Jesus, or of Moses, or of Abraham, or of Adam, or of other prophets and messengers that came before time. Well, provocatively, for those of you who know Anjum Chowdhury, an extremist preacher in this country who's now in jail, he would go out at Christmas, for example, and put up banners saying Jesus was a Muslim, right? And the point was, he's trying to, well, he was clearly being provocative, but what he was trying to do was to bring this point out about the Islamic view of history. And the reason is they look at these previous religions as having come about and as having been authentic, the true word of God. But then the people with whom those religious messages were entrusted began to squirrel them away, began to dilute them, began to trade away some of the rulings and understandings of what God wanted. And as a result, the religion became so diluted so as to become no longer the message and the word of God. Therefore, God makes a pact with mankind as a whole, and gives mankind one last chance for salvation, one last chance to get to heaven, which is why Islam comes about from the Muslim view of history. So Islam represents that last chance. It represents that last chance to get to heaven for all of mankind, which is why it's a universalist faith, why it's very easy to become a Muslim. There's no particular procedure. You just take the Islamic testament of faith by declaring you believe there is no God but God, and that Muhammad is the messenger of God, and that's it. There's no formal learning process, there's no recognized clergy that will give you a certificate, that's it, and you're in. So, what these guys say is they talk about it in the Arabic as an amana, as a trust, that God has placed on their shoulders for them to hold on to this last chance. Right? The idea was that man had been given so many chances and wasted them, that now God gave one last chance. So the Salafis not only want to go back to emulating that early era and reviving their Islamic practices, but what they also want to do is to not trade away one single thing, which makes it so difficult to have any conversation about anything that could be interpreted as modernizing the religion, that could be seen as trying to contextualize some of the rulings in a modern era. They don't have time for that. The world doesn't inform Islam. Islam informs the world. Islam doesn't adapt to fit the world. The world adapts to fit Islam. So that's the mindset of the Salafi. And the person who would be a Salafi today is operating in that way. So that's the first sort of point, in essence, that I thought I wanted you to take away. Who are these guys? Why do they act the way they do? Why are they being so rejectionist? In pretty much everything you see, or being so dogmatically opposed to any attempt to have an open conversation about their belief structure and the way it sits within the world today. This explains the reticence they have, or the reluctance they have to engage in anything that could be seen as sort of moving it on. Now, the good thing about most all slides just pictures. I don't want to bore you with text. The good thing about most Salafis is, in fact, they're not associated with violence. Although, of course, again, in the public debate, Salafism is a word that has become synonymous and very strongly coupled with violence and with terrorism. But that's not ultimately how most Salafis are. Most Salafis, like this individual, who's a Saudi state scholar and one of the imams from the Grand Mosque in Mecca, are quietists. And what I mean by that is they're not really worried about you, nor do they care in radical or revolutionary change. What they're concerned about is themselves. And they'll spend huge amounts of time debating precisely how long their beards should be, how they should fast in Ramadan, how they should wash and ritualize, sort of ritually clean themselves before prayer. You know, stuff that no one really cares about. But it's going to keep them really busy, right? That's, in essence, what the Salafi, quietest Salafi position is. And you see, in fact, again, when you look at the nuances of this whole movement, that this pattern of Salafism has been a basis of state stability in countries like Saudi Arabia. The use and employment of Salafism within Saudi Arabia by the state has provided great stability for that state, not necessarily states outside, but internally, at least, has provided a great degree of stability for that country because of the way the House of Saud and the Saudi religious establishment link up to work together in this way. So quietest Salafis don't care, in essence, is the issue. And you see that generally with a lot of the state clerics around the Gulf and the things that they believe in and preach and essentially articulate and want to forward and advance. So that you could say that's one big bulk. The second sort of categorization of Salafi is a kind of political Salafi. Now, these are not individuals who believe in terrorist activity. They don't believe in violence to change the state or to challenge the state, but they believe in intellectually challenging the state. So they will criticize the state by way of activism, by writing against the ruling family. They will challenge it by telling people they need to do things. And you've seen this kind of activism become much more pronounced in the Arab world, particularly since 2011, with the Arab uprisings that took place. This kind of engaged activist Salafi has become much more prominent in places like Egypt, in Jordan, in Saudi Arabia, and elsewhere. And so they're kind of needling away at the governments in the countries where they operate. But they're also condemning terrorism and telling people not to go out in that way. There's a fascinating Saudi cleric who wrote quite prolifically on this, actually. I did try to meet him last year, but I was unsuccessful, and he's subsequently been thrown into jail. But there's a guy called Salman Al-Oda, who really came to light in the early 1990s. And it's worth saying, in the development of radical political Islam in the Muslim world, 1990 and 1991 were hugely significant years, far more so than I think gets attention in the West, for the simple reason that that's the year in 1990 when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. And what that led to was the Saudi government entering into a military alliance with the United States to push Saddam out of Kuwait, to restore the Kuwaiti royal family, and to drive him back into Iraq. And that was a seminal moment in the intellectual development of political Islam, because what happened was, for the first time, you had dissent in countries like Saudi Arabia, public dissent, where people questioned the wisdom and the judgment of the royal family about the simple issue: can we have a military alliance with the United States? Is it allowed? Can you have the United States established military bases on what they regard as holy soil. The whole of the Arabian Peninsula is held and believed by these individuals to be sacred soil. So not only are you entering this alliance with the US, but you're also bringing them and inviting them onto sacred soil to establish military bases. So this was a huge, huge, huge moment. So these individuals emerge in what's known as the movement is known as the Sahwa. And you will have heard the word Sahwa in many places, such as Iraq as well, much more recently. Sahwa means awakening. And the Sahwa movement of the Sahwa Salafis, the awakening Salafis, came out strongly to challenge the governments at that time. Again, in 2011, when the uprisings happened, for example, in Saudi Arabia, these guys said, look, don't come out on the streets and protest. We don't encourage that because it could lead to social disorder. It could lead to civil strife. We want to preserve social order, law and order, and the maintenance of that status quo. However, the Saudi government has also failed in some of its obligations towards you. So what you should do is campaign for your rights by writing in newspapers, by going on Twitter, doing these things, to demand human rights, to demand an independent judiciary, to ask for freedom of speech and these types of things. So they're kind of trying to evolve or create a kind of third way Salafi channel and model of dissent, essentially, within the confines of the state and the way the state operates in those countries. As I say, as they did that, they found themselves getting thrown into jail. So not particularly effective from their perspective. Nonetheless, a very interesting intellectual position for these guys to hold, because if these countries are going to move, particularly as we see with the new Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, in that direction, these are the guys they're going to have to tolerate. And these are the guys whose channels or models of dissent they're going to have to start to engage with. So they're not quite ready for that yet. But as I say, this is the next sort of category of Salafism you could see. And it doesn't embrace violence. It's smaller than the previous group, the quietest, but not as small as the final one. The final one is, of course, what I'm particularly interested in, and these are the Salafi jihadis. So these are the parts of the Salafi spectrum who believe in radical revolutionary overhaul of the existing order. They believe in overturning the world and all of its international institutions and all of our understandings about pretty much everything as we understand them in a radical and transformative way. These are essentially groups like Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and various hangers-on who want to achieve, as I say, this new world and to create it in a particular fashion. So when I wrote my book on this, when I tackled this issue, what I said was, look, I'm not going to get into debates about contested terms or contested viewpoints on theology, because you know, that's for the actors themselves to play out. And what I'm going to do and what I'm going to do for the rest of my presentation is to simply adopt their understanding of these terms, because otherwise we'd be here for several hours, right? And it's a hot day. So we're going to take their view and their understanding of an idea, their understanding of a concept, and take that as a starting point, because it doesn't matter how another Muslim sees it, or whether there's a cleric down the road at a mosque who's saying, no, he's completely got that wrong. What matters is this guy understands that to be the truth, and that truth informs his worldview, and that truth informs this ideology that gives direction and meaning to their actions. So that's what we need to look at and to understand. So I said, to be a Salafi jihadi, you need to believe in five ideas, and I adopted an intellectual history approach to this study that I did, which was to track and trace and measure essentially the trajectory of these ideas over the course of the last 30 years in particular, in some cases over the last 100 years, and to see how they evolved and got to the endpoints where they're at. And what you see actually is why this is such a resilient movement, how it's withstood and absorbed really and endured almost two-decade war on terror, several decades of state repression, and yet continues to grow and emerge. So what are the five ideas? Unsurprisingly, the first idea is jihad, right? You have to believe in jihad to be a Salafi jihadi. The next idea is takfir, the idea of excommunication. I'll come on and talk about these in turn in more depth. But the next idea is takfir. And then the third idea is one which is called al-wala wal-bara, which, to put it into English, doesn't translate directly or neatly, but essentially means loyalty and hate, or love and hate, loyalty and disavowal for the sake of God. It's kind of aligning your personal likes and dislikes and beliefs with what God wants you to think and say and do about these matters. And then the fourth idea is Tawheed, the idea of monotheism. It's the Islamic concept of monotheism. And then the final one is on Hakimiyya, the idea of governance or Islamic governance in that context. So in essence, these are the five ideas you need to believe in. And what I say is, look, these ideas all exist within normative Islam. There's nothing particularly controversial or, you know, esoteric about them within the mainstream or normative body of Islamic scripture, knowledge, thinking, or works. But what is important is, again, the unique things, the unique interpretations of these ideas, the particular or peculiar understandings that the Salafi Jihadi movement has about each one of these ideas that does make them slightly disnormative and slightly disjointed from the mainstream understandings. So with jihad, which we've seen now, of course, taking place all over the world in organized forms in Syria and Iraq and lone actor forms on the streets of London or Manchester and all these different settings as we've come to understand them. The important understanding is for these guys, they elevated jihad and made it into something. It was twofold. One, they said jihad has, yes, a linguistic meaning, which you may have heard, which means to struggle. So yes, your struggle could be waking up at 7 a.m. to go and do some activity. That's not jihad in the legal sense. And the legal meaning of the term is to fight. It always means to fight. So jihad is a militaristic concept in all forms and at all times, according, as I say, to this movement and its understanding of the term. And the second term, aspect of this concept was they said, look, jihad is a ritualistic obligation, just like prayer, fasting, going on pilgrimage, paying charity. Fighting jihad is on the same level, it's the same type of thing. So it's an attempt to normalize what is otherwise quite an extraordinary thing, to try and bring people towards it, to try and bring people into doing it, and to try and make you a jihadi in that way, to say, look, this is what you need to do, and the way you do it is by coming and fighting. So fighting becomes an obligation. And fighting becomes the mechanism, primarily and principally, by which you defend the faith. And don't forget, they've grown with this siege mentality, right? The faith is under constant attack. It's under attack by Muslims who are squirreling away and who are going to compromise its true essence so as to make it redundant, like religions that came before. But it's also by under attack from external forces that want to do the same thing to it. So it's this pact with God. You have to defend the pact with God. And you do that by preserving the purity of what is behind you. And if that means fighting, then that's what you have to do. So fighting takes on this hugely important but spiritual role as well, which is why you see suicide bombers and these individuals talking about going to embrace God. They don't see it as death. They see it as a movement from one aspect of life to another aspect of life. There's no real concept at all of dying in that context or in that setting. The second idea of takfir, this is where it gets sort of interesting, right? So takfir is the notion of excommunication, to put it bluntly, where you declare another Muslim to be outside the fold of the faith. And what that does is it licenses the kind of sectarian conflict that we've seen so brutally waged in places like Syria and Iraq by Sunnis and Shias, happening both ways. And I say this concept exists on both sides, for want of a better term, and is used by both sides, again, to use that term, to fuel and drive their supporters and members into fighting and killing one another. So why is takfir important? Well, takfir is important because, again, if you have this pristine doctrine, then you have to protect it from insidious threats. If there are people inside the faith who are claiming to interpret it in one way or another, who are taking you away from the truth, then you need to find a way to expel them in order to maintain the primacy of what it is that you have. So takfir is a very important doctrine that has been revived and weaponized throughout Islamic history by extremists at various times in order to wage war against those they deem or they regard as undermining the faith from within. So it's not really about external threats, it's about internal threats. And so periodically we've seen the use of takfir, but really, where it roared back into contemporary relevance, where it roared back into contemporary significance, was as a result of the 2003 invasion of Iraq, where Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who led al-Qaeda in Iraq at the time, really prioritized fighting the Shia, principally in the southern parts of Iraq, over and above even fighting the United States or Britain and the other coalition members that invaded the country. He was so against the Shia that he said, look, the West is the infidel decadent West. Well, we know who they are, but these guys, the Shias, they're fighting us from within. They're the enemy from within, so we have to prioritize the struggle against them over and above this thing. So you saw the unraveling and the unleashing of this very, very nasty sectarian current in the region as a result of 2003, which only gathered pace after 2011 in Syria, and as we've seen, has become particularly devastating to that region, and one which I think will continue to haunt that region now for decades and decades to come. So that's a second concept, essentially, as it sits within the movement of Takfir. The third of al-wala wal-bara, again, is utilized, interestingly, in the modern concept, in the modern world as a militaristic concept, but doesn't really have that. It started off during the Prophet Muhammad's time as this doctrine of kind of trying to distinguish themselves, the new Muslims, from the broader Meccan society where Islam began. To try and distinguish themselves in terms of appearance, dress, festivals, greetings, because they were different, right? And they were growing and emerging in what was a polytheistic society with this monotheistic message. So they wanted to come at it very, very differently and to challenge the polytheism of that Meccan society with their monotheistic worldview and doctrine. So when they emerge in that way, it's really about, as I say, personal things, clothing, appearance, greetings, so on. When the first and second Saudi states arose, and you know, we're on the third Saudi state, which is the one that endured, but the first and second, they arose and they collapsed. Al-Wala al-Bara began to emerge and get used as a doctrine for making alliances between tribes. So it suddenly took on this sort of, you could say, a role within international relations to say, tribe A to tribe B, you need to work with us because tribe C is attacking us and they're not Muslim. Therefore, we're Muslims and we're under attack. You owe us allegiance and loyalty. You have, God obligates you to fight with us against this external enemy. So takfir is being used for internal policing, you could say, of a group dynamic. But al-wala wal-bara is being used to forge in-group love and harmony. We're all brothers, we should work together. Versus the external enemy. The United States is invading Iraq, we must unite. So it takes on this relevance in that context. And it kind of, once the third Saudi state was established, it really, we didn't see it being used very much in a political context or being utilized in a particular way for quite some time until 9/11. And then Al-Qaeda begins to use it to say, look, come work with us. Even if you disagree with what we did, you have to give us your support because we're still Muslims and these guys are not. They're trying to arrest us and throw us into Guantanamo Bay. You owe us loyalty, if nothing else, because we're your brothers. We might have made a mistake, who knows, but back us, work with us. So it becomes this interesting tool again in that context for a group like Al-Qaeda to try and forge relationships and trying to build a network and alliance around them to drive them forward. And of course, we saw Islamic State use that as well, very, very dramatically, in fact, in the Syrian context. And it worked for them a lot. One of the reasons Islamic State grew so quickly and so dramatically was its ability to form alliances with many other groups. Really, the name ISIS was an umbrella term. They were absorbing lots of different groups that had taken power and control on the ground and just affiliating them almost in a federalized structure through the large umbrella movement. So al-wala wal-bara has become this very interesting militarized term in its use and deployment today and the way we see it being operated, as I say, as a tool of international relations. What it originally started off as a very personal, private doctrine of personal behavior and moral code and manners and behaviors and festivals, it's sort of taken on this new life of its own. So if you bundle up those three ideas, jihad, takfir, wala wal-bara, they're quite militaristic. They're kind of operational on the battlefield. You see them being utilized and referenced by jihadi scholars in the field all the time, right? So if you see a video coming out from ISIS, these concepts get referenced a lot. They're talked about a lot. There are books hundreds of pages long, very boring. But they talk about these things, trying to win support, or at least trying to justify what they're doing. Because if you are Al-Qaeda and you're releasing a big bomb in downtown Baghdad in 2005, killing women, children, ordinary civilians in a marketplace, you have to explain and try and rationalize why you're doing that to the Arab and Muslim world to keep them on your side. So there's a lot of literature looking at these ideas because they are real time, they are playing out daily on the streets and on the battlefields, and they kind of lend themselves to what I call a kind of ad hoc real-time theology as a result. They kind of make these things up a lot as they're going. So they try to find interesting bits of justification to sort of move the argument along in terms of what it is they're doing. Then you have the last two ideas, which are not so operational, which are slightly more abstract, or largely have been traditionally. So you see less about them, and the writings on them are a bit more historical, which is the fourth idea of Tawheed, of monotheism. Now again, this isn't a controversial idea at all. You can't be a Muslim without being a monotheist, right? If you had to sum up Islam in one word, it's monotheism. It's a belief in one single God, one deity. But what the jihadi movement does is it says, look, God is iridescent. God is owed so many different things. And there are different ways that you achieve and satisfy those different conditions of God. So when it's time for one of the five daily prayers, you satisfy God's rights by praying. When it's the month of Ramadan, you satisfy God's rights by fasting. When the particular time of the year comes to pay charity, you have to give a particular amount. That's the time to do that. Or to make the pilgrimage to Mecca in the Hajj. Okay, these things are fairly straightforward. You kind of know how to do them. It's not that contentious. But the jihadi movement said, look, but God has got so many other things that you're not doing. And you can't demonstrate it to God unless you do certain actions. So one of the things is a concept within Islam of called al-qada wal-qadr. And this is sort of predestination and fate. And it basically says that, look, God fixed certain things. All Muslims believe that God predefined certain things. So the level of your wealth, for example, is fixed by God. That means doesn't mean you don't go out and work and expect to find your riches. You have to go out and seek your wealth, but God will define whether you'll be a rich person or a poor person, and so on. God also defined how many children you'll have. But most importantly, in this context, God defined your lifespan. And the Quran talks about this, saying there's nothing that you as an individual can do to move the length of your life forward or to bring it nearer. Now, this concept gets really interesting, right? Because what does the jihadi movement say? The jihadi movement says, how do you demonstrate to God you really believe that idea? How do you demonstrate to God you really are committed to that notion? Well, the only way to do it is to risk your life. And the way you do that is by coming to the battlefield and fighting jihad. Because if you're going to die on the streets of London, cycling to work, you may as well come to Raqqa and be a fighter with ISIS. Why would you not? Coming to Aleppo is no more important than going to, no more dangerous than going to Aberdeen or Aberystwyth or wherever, because you will die when it's your moment. Death will find you. So come and be part of this. Don't let the fear of your death dissuade you from coming to the battlefield. So it's a very liberating concept in a way for fighters. It's what helps them drive their guys. It's also what helps them, you keep your forces motivated if you're ISIS and you're losing Mosul and you're losing Raqqa and you know this big caliphate you built is being pushed back. You keep your fighters going by saying, it's a test from God. God determines these things. We just have to put in the effort. We don't know what the result will be. Let's keep going. So it's hugely empowering, it's emancipating and powerful for these individuals, but it has this other religious guilt aspect to it as well, which is really powerful again, which is you're saying to Muslims who don't fight jihad, you can't fully satisfy the monotheism of God. You can't be a true Muslim if you don't fight jihad because you don't satisfy the criteria of Tawheed, because you can't demonstrate your belief in one of the core doctrinal issues of Islam, that you believe that God predetermined all these things. If you believe in that, then come and be part of this. And again, if you look at and study and look at the accounts and testimonies of the thousands, tens of thousands of foreign fighters who migrated from across the world, maybe 5,000 or 6,000 from Europe, to go and be part of this project out in Iraq and Syria, they talk about that very thing. That's the thing that motivated someone from Portsmouth to go out to Raqqa and die with this group. So it plays out very much in the way that these individuals behave and act and what they do. And I think it's really interesting to see that as a weaponized concept to keep your army motivated or to inspire your soldiers in that way. And then there's the final point I talk about, the fifth of the core ideas is of hakimiyya, is of governance, Islamic governance. The idea that God is the sole legislator, that humans, mankind, doesn't have the ability or the right to dictate or decide what laws should be, that the Sharia is the sole source of legislation, God legislates, man does not. And in fact, this is one of God's rights, one of God's attributes within Islam, is the notion that God is the giver of law, not man, and therefore that God's rights should be followed. Now, that particular idea and its trajectory is quite long. You don't find, interestingly, Osama bin Laden, for example, or Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, or any of these groups talking about this concept very much at all. And the reason is, I think, because in essence, the kind of hard work on it has already been done. Groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, Sayyid Qutb, wrote very much about this idea. Before them and before Sayyid Qutb, Maududi from the Indian subcontinent wrote a lot about the concept of Islamic governance. So that idea of the caliphate, that idea of having an Islamic state, that idea of the Sharia taking supremacy over any other sort of system of law or being the sole source of law of a state, not just of personal conduct, but of a state, has kind of been done through most of the 20th century, so that when groups like Al-Qaeda came along, they didn't really feel the need to have to say much. It had already been said. The contours of that debate had already been set. So there wasn't a need to really tackle it too strongly from their perspective. And so you find, interestingly, a sort of dearth of literature from the Salafi jihadi movement about the very issue which they're striving to get to, that end point they're aiming to get to, which is the establishment of that Islamic state. They don't actually talk about it that much. Even, ironically, Islamic State itself doesn't talk much about what it was trying to do. It just did it. And it sort of achieved authority through praxis at the end by saying, well, we've established it, here it is, and we've done it. So there wasn't a sense of trying to develop it any more than that. But as I say, those ideas are well established and they're well entrenched in large parts of the Arab and Muslim world more broadly, with differing views on what a caliphate is, what it looks like, what it should be. I'll give a few concluding remarks, then I'll open it up to a Q&A and allow you to ask anything you want on the issue. What I found is that this is an idea, Salafi jihadism, that has continued to evolve quite rapidly over certainly the last 3 to 4 decades, but really intensified in its intellectual development in 2003. The Iraq War was a hugely important and significant intellectual moment in the development of this movement and in the development of core ideas relating to how this movement behaves, thinks, acts, and does the things that it does. Every war that came about, really, so starting, you know, with Afghanistan in the 1980s, or the Algerian Civil War in the 1990s, or the Egyptian Islamic Jihad campaigns against their own leaders at various points in the 1990s, the invasion of Kuwait, and so on, they all lead to important moments of intellectual development in terms of how this movement understands itself, in how it's prepared to use ever more barbaric forms of violence and to license violence in increasingly indiscriminate and promiscuous ways. And we're seeing the same thing happen in Syria and Iraq today. These are hugely intense conflicts. They are conflicts that are nowhere near the end, despite what Trump might say of beating ISIS. We have not beaten ISIS. But even if we had them, these conflicts are nowhere near the end of their own trajectories. And what that means is you have an intellectual life, at least a militaristic one, within these theaters of war where these doctrines and ideas continue to evolve, continue to develop. ISIS was one of the more interesting actors in that sense, because we saw really extreme forms of violence licensed by them, that even other jihadi groups, even Al-Qaeda, said, whoa, that's pretty extreme. And to give an example of that, the Jordanian pilot who crashed into ISIS territory, Muad al-Kasasbeh, if you remember, he was captured by ISIS and then put in a cage and burned alive. And even for groups like Al-Qaeda, that was held to be a very extreme thing that they had done. And that led to, again, behind the scenes at least, a very profound theological discussion about the permissibility of this particular type of attack. So we are going to continue to see these ideas evolve. We're going to continue to see them develop. And certainly what we're seeing right now in the Levant will write another chapter of what I think, and as I said at the very start, is a hugely resilient movement. It's a movement that has shown its ability to persevere. It has moved the dial in the Middle East, but also across the world. And as I say, it has an inherent resilience built into what it believes. And so I would say, just on that point, you know, this is not a problem or a threat or a crisis that we're anywhere near resolving, but it's very much a work in progress, and you'll continue to see it evolve over the coming decades. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for today, but there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.